The Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror!
Hello, horror hounds. Today we're ripping up a two-course meal of grade A genetically modified foodstuffs. Join me, the Crisp Keeper, and my fellow culinary criminals, the Hair Metal Hero and El Jacone, as we warm up with a plate of roasted space carrot in the 1951 classic, The Thing from Another World, followed up by a meaty pâté of intergalactic shape-shifting spider in John Carpenter's The Thing.
All right, we're off and running with a double feature here this week with the original 1951 The Thing from Another World and the 1982 remake reimagining John Carpenter's The Thing. And so let's start off with the old movie first. What did you guys think? Have you seen this movie? Have you guys seen this movie before now?
I did not. I watched it for the first time in preparation for the show.
I had seen The Thing from Another World several times as a kid and as a young man. I hadn't seen it in probably 10 years before I rewatched it.
And I probably haven't seen it since I was a little kid, and you know, I just remembered basically two sequences from it. The sequence where they were they find the UFO, or they're so, you know, they sort of, all the guys sort of spread out around the edges of the UFO, and the scene where James Arness comes through the door and they douse him with kerosene and light him up. I remembered that scene really well, and everything else was just sort of a blur, except that I remembered that it had me just wound up the wall. You know, it was so tense and frightening. And this time, you know, I wasn't really scared, but boy, I really appreciated it as a movie.
Yeah, I mean, you're watching it now in the present context, you know.
Yeah.
Versus, you know, when you saw it as a little kid, or when audiences first saw it in the 50s, you know, now obviously you know the everything that's come after it has kind of, you know, pushed the envelope, so to speak. But for just good solid sci-fi filmmaking, you know, Thing from Another World, there's a reason why it's had received the accolades it has. It's just a well-made film in pretty much every dimension.
You know what it reminded me in a few ways is Fantastic Planet, but that's a cartoon. Forbidden Planet, which was, you know, Forbidden Planet was definitely like a big budget version of it, but both of them just sort of had an A grade script to them. You know, the script didn't talk down to the audience. It was light and goofy, but it was a well thought out movie, and it took its scares seriously, which was rare in those kinds of movies in those days.
Yeah, one of the notes I have is it's not juvenile. You know, it compares with some of its contemporaries like Them and The Day the Earth Stood Still, and that. You know, even though it's a genre picture, it treats the subject matter with respect, and, you know, it approaches it from a more mature standpoint than the usual schlock that we were getting at the drive-ins at, you know, this time.
And I always forget, too, that it at that time period, even though there were lots of schlocky movies about it, UFOs were a little more serious thing. They were a new thing, and they were in the context of, you know, the sort of Cold War, post-World War II, you know, communist paranoia, and all of a sudden we're seeing UFOs. So, you know, I mean, this movie might have been even more scary because I mean, UFOs were kind of scary to people, and so I think the goofy movies maybe helped diffuse that fear a little bit, but I don't think this, and this was also a nice healthy dose of fear of outsiders, you know, on top of that. And I think it really must have, you know, I was trying to put myself in the place of a viewer at that time period watching this movie and thinking, you know, it probably like a lot like I felt when I saw Alien the first time when I was a kid and said, wow, this movie really is trying to approach what this would really be like, you know, and not, you know, put a layer of theatricality on it. Although now it is kind of theatrical, you know, with the way the dialogue is and stuff, but you know, that's a artifact of the time. I don't know, what did you think, Chris, having never seen it before, but you'd seen the Carpenter thing before.
Oh yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
So how did this, because I saw this before I saw the Carpenter version, so I'm wondering how it felt for you as a full grown adult. You know, it probably didn't strike terror into your heart.
It didn't strike terror into my heart, but for what it was, I mean, especially the context of the time, it definitely felt a lot more paranoid than I thought it would for something that was coming from that time. But the dialogue was very snappy. It seemed to have a more modern sensibility in terms of the dialogue. There are some tropes of 1950s cinema that, I mean, they accept that thing as a spacecraft pretty damn quick.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. They didn't go, hey, you know, I wonder if the Ruskies dropped this thing. You're right.
Yeah. I was kind of expecting that, but it was, oh, yeah, it's a spaceship. Gotta be. What else could it be?
It was the lowest budget spaceship too. I love it. It was just a tail fin sticking out of the ice, and then like they cleared off a nice round part of ice. It just, I loved that. I was like, that is the most awesome way to save some special effects money.
Oh yeah, and then they blow the shit out of it, so they never have to show
it. Less is more with that, you know. Mm-hmm. And you're right, they do blow the shit out of it, don't they?
Yeah, and then, so. So then all you got to do is make a few like broken up parts in a brick of ice and you're all set, special effects wise. You know, all you had to do is wrap James Arness in some asbestos, you know, layers of asbestos, and you're ready to go with this movie.
Do you really think James Arness took that flame shot? That wasn't a stuntman?
Oh, I'm sure it was a stuntman. Yeah. Well, you never know. You never know in those days. I mean, I don't know James Arness's history, but I wouldn't, you know, doubt it. A lot of people started out as a stuntman. That could be why he got the part, you know?
Yeah, I don't know either way, you know, but all I can think of is, you know, Glenn Strange, the gentleman who played the Frankenstein monster in the closing days of the Universal series,
uh-huh.
in both House of Frankenstein, House of Dracula, and then in Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. He started out as a heavy in westerns and as a stuntman, and he did his own fire effects. That was one of the reasons that he got the job, is he was willing to, one, endure the makeup, and two, do his own effects.
Yeah, it's so, I mean, there were a lot of actors who became, or people who got to be on screen just for sheer pragmatic, practical reasons. Like, didn't the guy who ended up being the creature from the Black Lagoon, basically, I think he became that because he designed the suit and knew how to wear it.
Rico Browning.
Rico Browning.
He played the creature in the underwater scenes because he could hold his breath for approaching like 3 minutes.
Ah, okay.
And he was a diver and an underwater photographer, and he, since he could hold his breath so long, and he could remember his direction and, you know, do the scenes where he's swimming with Julia Adams or whatnot. That's how Browning played it. They got a bigger guy to play him on land, but. You know, again, yeah, you're right. It's necessity is the mother of invention. It's like, we need to shoot these long scenes underwater. We need somebody who can hold his breath and still move.
And, you know, I mean, outside of if Arnest wasn't doing his own stunts, then there wasn't a lot for him to do in that movie, frankly. Yeah. If you think about it, you know.
Yeah. But I tell you, one of the on the DVD I have of Carpenter's This Thing, there's a very good featurette, documentary featurette, and one of the first things they talk about the original Thing from Another World, and one thing Carpenter says is that when he was watching the film as a young man, he saw it in the theater, and I don't know if this was the, I'm guessing with his age, probably was for the initial release, and he said that every time something scary would happen, popcorn kept flying up out of his lap, you know, and the scene he specifically talks about is when they're getting ready to go into the greenhouse, and they've got the Geiger counter, and all the men are there, and they open up the door, and boom, there's James Arness, and he takes the big roundhouse swing,
yeah.
And he misses, and he gets hand caught in the door. And, you know, I knew that was coming, and it still takes you. When you know it's coming, like, oh, it's like just right there. It's like a smash cut before a smash cut was invented.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, I mean, up until that very point, pretty much as soon as that monster's loose, every scene up until that point is them walking through some door. You know, walking up to a door, and then there's a bunch of doors, and they're, okay, open all these doors. Yeah, and one of those doors, he's bound to be behind it. I mean, it was funny, I was just, that horror documentary I was talking about in the last episode had Carpenter saying just that. He's just like, you know, you open one of those doors and you know one of them, he's going to be there. And sure enough, he's there. And even though you know it's coming, it's still going to get you, you know. And it was just classic. It played with all the classic, just basic primal, you know, elements of horror, of being isolated in a hostile environment and, you know, in small cramped quarters with no real recourse, you know, outside of whatever you've got there, you know. The cavalry may show up, but it's not going to show up until, you know, it's too late. So, you know, one thing I did notice about this movie that was different from the remake, there's a lot of things different from the remake, but that just sort of is different from movies of modern movies was just how well everybody in this movie got along. There was only one really quote unquote, I wouldn't even call him a bad guy, maybe a foil more, is the scientist, you know, who's just refuses to let go of his idea that, you know, this creature is super intelligent and could be, you know, communicated with. But everybody else, there's a little good-natured barb here and there, you know, some jaunty banter. But when the cards are all down, everybody works together. Everybody's on the same page and ready to go. And that's, you know, whether it's the way they write movies, it's the way they write movies today or the way society is today, but, you know, there would have been a lot more, there would have been some character tension in this. In this, everything's pretty, you don't really have any sort of character problems. It's the good guys versus the monster, and with just a scientist thrown in to sort of cloud things up a little bit, because if the scientist wasn't there, then that you know, we never would have, you know, the problem wouldn't have been exacerbated as much as it is, you know.
Yeah.
So he was sort of there almost as a plot element.
Right. Well, I think a lot of that is, you know, again, we're getting to the era in which this was shot. You know, 1951, we're in the post-war boom, you know. Everybody's back from the war. The economy is building again. The moves to the suburbs are happening. Everybody's real big on America right now. You know, we had just won the war.
Yeah.
There was nothing we couldn't do.
That's true.
And it's this, you know, it's the, right now, the, I mean, the main threat wasn't, you know, in the 50s, we weren't as concerned about, you know, this is before, you know, hippies, and this is before the drug revolution.
Well,
all three of us
grew up in the
united.
Post-Vietnam. Yeah, we grew up in post-Vietnam horror movies.
Yeah, this is definitely that type of, you know, American ingenuity. We know what we're doing, and we're going to get it done type of, you know, that this is very typical of the of filmmaking in the 50s. It was, you know, it was very much a celebration of America and what American ingenuity can accomplish.
Yep, but just not too much egghead ingenuity. Don't go too far with it, though.
But one thing I that struck me was when they show up at the base, and lo and behold, there's two women at the base. I was completely not expecting that to have it.
They had to. You had to.
And then the standard, you know, the leader of the soldiers has to have the love interest. I was like, really? Okay, I wasn't expecting that. But
somebody's got to have that dialogue, you know.
And it was great dialogue, too.
You've got to have the, even though, you know, if you cast the Directors Guild, it was, you know, Christian Nyby who directed this. We all pretty much assume that Howard Hawks had a large part in this film.
Right.
He did an uncredited rewrite on the script, you know, and there are a lot of people that suspect that he shot a good portion of this film. And, you know, Margaret Sheridan's character is very much in line with what is called the Hawksian woman. You know, she's on equal footing with her male counterparts. She has the witty repartee back and forth. She's a tough romantic lead. And so she fits in nicely, and it does kind of break things up a little bit because, you know, it's typical, again, of the filmmaking of the era. Howard Hawks had a saying that the way to make a good picture is have three great scenes and no bad scenes, you know? And if there's ever a film, I think, that exemplifies that, The Thing from Another World kind of hits that mark, you know? And so in a lot of ways, again, we talked about this before, even though this was a genre picture, it's still shot with the sensibilities of let's make an A movie. You know, let's not shoot a B movie, let's shoot an A movie. And having a strong female romantic lead in there, a foil to our hero. I mean, and that stuff, I mean, it's pretty funny too when, you know, they're in the other room and they're having the drink and so she ties them up. I mean, that cracks me up because it's just silly in a, you don't expect some, you know, something that's really just straight comic relief in a film like this.
Oh, that's right. And then she's like, "Hey, how long have you been loose?" Yeah, long enough. I know that on the DVD release of this, I know John Carpenter did like the commentary, and I know he's a huge Howard Hawks fan, so that just adds more credence to the, you know, to how much influence he had on the direction of this movie. And I haven't checked this, but I know that John Carpenter is like the official Howard Hawks historian for the American Film Institute or something like that, or, you know, he's the one who, you know, maintains all the information on Howard Hawks and knows all the trivia about him and stuff like that. And this movie just had that, it just felt like a Howard Hawks movie, you know. It literally reminded me of a, you know, we would spend a lot of film school watching Howard Hawks movies, and so it reminded me of sitting in film class in some ways, you know. And although a good genre movie always takes me out of analysis, you know.
That's a sign of a good film of any genre, if you can. Especially if you've had any type of background in film school or scholarly film critique, is like if you can watch the film and just be entertained,
you know it's a good movie. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. If it's a really horrible movie, if it's a really horribly written movie, sometimes I will actually see the script and the awkward dialogue in the script. And and sometimes if I'm really bored at a movie, and it happens more when I'm watching the movie in a theater, I'll literally start seeing where the lights have been placed and thinking, okay, well, there's probably another camera over there and stuff like that. That's very rare that I'll see a theatrical movie that's that bad. I think Congo was the last one that did that to me. That was a long time ago, too.
I enjoyed Congo.
I enjoyed Congo now. I didn't enjoy it on that particular... It might have been the date that I was on that colored that particular movie in some ways. It's hard to say.
I'll just always remember for having the most ignominious demise of Bruce Campbell in film ever.
Oh, that's
all
right.
I
Bruce Campbell
from
is
Congo
in
is stop eating my sesame cake. That's.
Oh yeah, that was great.
I'm a fan of monkeys. I'm a fan of monkeys killing people or monkeys doing anything.
Drinking martinis.
Anything. Sure. Washing cats in a sink. I don't care what it is. If it has a monkey going on in it, it's so I was like pretty excited about this movie, and it was, I think, the only other monkey movie that was maybe as disappointing in the theater experience for me was Burton's Planet of the Apes. I was really wound up for that monkey movie, and it never monkeyed out like I thought it should have. But that's another.
Yeah, I actually read Congo.
So did I.
Yeah,
and then you go to see the movie, and you're like, wow, remember that good book I read?
Yeah.
What happened to that?
I love Michael Crichton's books. I started on Michael Crichton by seeing The Andromeda Strain, and that made me read the book, and then I was hooked after that. Mm. But
we talked about Howard Hawks' influence on the thing. One of my favorite lines in this movie, because if you're not paying attention, you'll miss it. Right when they're getting ready to do the kerosene, they ask the reporter, "You ever handle anything like this in the war?" He's like, "No, but I saw Gary Cooper and Sergeant York."
Oh, I didn't even. I missed that.
Yeah, that's what I said. I don't think I'd ever notice that until I watched it this time. Like, Sergeant York? Ah. And for our listeners who may not be as well versed in the works of Howard Hawks, Sergeant York was a very, very, very successful and well regarded film starring Gary Cooper that he made prior to writing The Thing from Another World.
Or our listeners who might not be as old as us. I had to explain to one of my internet friends what a drive-in theater was, you know, to...
You're bullshitting me.
No, I was 17 years old.
But the concept of a drive-in theater? They never saw the Flintstones?
I didn't even think to bring that up, you know? I didn't even think to say, oh, you remember the beginning of the Flintstones? That's it right there. No, they had never heard of a drive-in theater. And they were living in the Midwest, and I would assume that in the Midwest there'd probably be a few more drive-in... I mean, they're sort of coming back now, but, I would think in the Midwest that would be a haven for whatever was left of drive-in theaters. But, no, I had to... I was... Yeah. Yeah, that blew their mind, and then it went the extra step of, like... What was left of their brain just dribbled out onto the ground when I told them that they even had ones that were X-rated. No way! Oh, yeah.
That's,
one of my best friends was conceived at one of those.
That's a hell of a story.
That's always a proud moment when your parents tell you that, you know. Come here, sit on Daddy's lap. I'm going to tell you a story. Mommy and Daddy went to see Debbie Does Dallas, and...
At the drive.
It was just a very romantic night, and there was wine involved, and that's how you happened.
You see, you know, when there was, you know, X-rated drive-in theaters, you actually needed to remember to put the speaker on your window because there was a plot to follow as well.
Right.
You know, because otherwise you're just not going to know who's who, and it's not, you know, the conflict isn't going to matter.
It's exactly. God, I remember... You know, I mean, it was... I'm just so happy that I can actually have the memory of actually being in the drive-in theater with the tray that you could put on your window that would hook onto the window that would have the food in it, you know, from the... from the concession stand. And we would buy you would buy these little spiral things. They look like an electric stovetop. And you would light them on fire, and they would sort of burn in the spiral pattern and scare away the mosquitoes, you know,
the bugs,
supposedly.
Yeah. Well, you see, I'm a little spoiled, not to get too far on this tangent, but I used to live in Aiken, South Carolina for several years. And about 30 to 40 minutes drive from Aiken is a little town called Mineta, which is home to the Big Mo Drive-In, which was a very popular drive-in in the 50s and 60s that... was shut down and abandoned, and it was purchased by a local couple, I guess about 10 years ago at this point, and they rebuilt it and brought it back to its former grandeur and added a second screen. And every weekend for the entire summer, they have first-run movies on a double feature on both screens every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and they are packed to capacity every single time.
Why wouldn't you be? I mean, it's the greatest thing in the world. The drive-in theater that from my hometown that Scott and I used to go to as kids is the same sort of thing happened. I think it was in the last, like, 3 or 4 years that somebody who's... It looked like a young couple. They were probably about, you know, my age in their early 40s who decided to, you know, they were going to either tear down the screen and put two small screens in, but they decided to refurbish the old huge screen, and they basically... I haven't been there yet, but I saw a video of it, and it's exactly the way it was when we were kids. I've got to go back there sometime. Yeah. It would be really cool.
Yeah, and the drive-ins do now is instead of the speaker, they actually broadcast from a low-power FM station.
Yeah.
So you either listen to your car radio, or you bring a little boombox radio and just tune to the correct station, and you get the sound right there.
Mm-hmm. And they were doing that when we were kids, because I
remember... Oh, really? I never went to a drive-thru as a kid. So,
to a small extent, you know. In the last few years, they would do it on the FM, and I rigged up an antenna, and I would listen to... I remember listening to, like, Firefox every night for, like, a week when I was a kid. I could tune in Firefox, and I'd hear Clint Eastwood at the drive-in, I remember listening to Empire Strikes Back, like, but going to sleep at night.
Wow.
It's very, very, very exciting, and it would be like tuning in and tuning out, and yeah, it was different. It was like E.T. back then, you know. You had to rig up weird things out of your speak and spell to drag in a signal of something to watch TV or listen to the radio.
Well, I got to see the film Cars at the drive-in, so I thought that was just the perfect film to watch at a drive-in theater. And at the end of Cars, of course, they're at the drive-in theater watching.
Right.
Yeah.
It's... What was that? Was that Peter Bogdanovich directed that? Was that... Who directed that? Somebody... Whoever directed that went on to direct a lot of other really good movies.
Directed Cars?
Yes. Well, it was like Peter Bogdanovich or something like that.
On my DVD, it doesn't have credits here. I'm not sure who directed Cars off the top of my head.
I remember Dead End Drive-In playing it at our drive-in. If you guys have ever seen, which is set at it's like a drive-in. It's a like Mad Max future, where all the, you know, people are kept in a sort of concentration camp, which is basically a drive-in where they show propaganda movies. And keep them at the drive. It was terrible. Terrible. It was awesome seeing it at the drive-in, though, you know, because you're watching it at the drive-in and people... You're watching on the screen as people get killed in front of a drive-in screen watching a movie. It's just... You don't get that shit anymore. But anyway, boy, the John Carpenter thing would have been nice to see at a drive-in. I probably could have. It probably did play at our drive-in, but I never saw it. I don't think I got to catch it till it hit HBO.
Yeah. Well, before we move on, anybody have any last thoughts on The Thing from Another World?
Yes. I think the line... There's two things that struck me. One was, I can't believe that little tiny electric blanket melted that block of ice.
Without shorting out.
Yeah. And just the fact that they called the thing a vegetable, a super carrot.
A carrot, yeah.
That was that made me chuckle.
That didn't add to the terror that much.
No, it didn't.
I love the shot where the guy, you know, he's talking about, I can't stand the way it's looking at. It seems like it's looking at me, and you know, it's all just you. But then they actually show a shot of it, but it's so vague. It's just this weird, toothy, lumpy something sort of looking out. And I remember seeing that and going, man, that's 10 times creepier than if you could see his head and eyes and, you know, if you knew exactly what was going on there, you know? So I thought that was really I love how it's the exact opposite of what's coming. It's all this one is all, you know, subtlety, you know, showing you the bare minimum and having a lot of stuff happen off screen, and that's gonna get tossed right out the window on fire, into the snow, screaming.
And all I have to say in closing of the thing of another world is, holy cats! Which is now the quote, my quote on my blog right now is, holy cats, in honor of this film.
I'm hoping exclamations like that come back, you know? They just, you know, that, I mean, I don't know, maybe we're just too cynical, not, you know, but maybe we've just graduated to holy shit, you know,
You know, I went to Catholic school. I went to Catholic grammar school, and then a Catholic high school. So, needless to say, especially in high school, foul language was very much frowned upon.
Right.
But you had to be creative. So when I was in high school, I swear to God, I used to yell, "Great Caesar's ghost!" all the time.
Oh, man.
Well, Scott and I had a friend who was a minister's son, and he had to say stuff like, "Nerds! Ah, nerds!" Nerds, really? And I remember he said nerds, and my grandfather was around, and my grandfather was like, "Oh, there's a fine boy right there." Upstanding lad. By gum. All right, well, let's get on to the gru and the gore and the grime. And I love how the John Carpenter movie starts out with, like, you know, it's a Spielberg shot, you know, of a spaceship. You know, it almost has.
I never thought of it like that. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
I was just like, oh yeah, it's an '80s movie. It was saying, ah yes, that's right. We know space. You know, woo. But it's still an old fashioned
saucer.
Yeah.
Saucer.
And but it's still got that '80s, you know, cocoon sort of thing going on, and then from that point on, it's a gritty John Carpenter movie. It's a down to earth, you know. From the minute that thing crashes, it's just, you know, there's nothing spacey or goofy about it. It's a pretty visceral movie.
Yeah. Well, speaking about the opening of the film, one thing that I really like, if you look at the poster or the trailer or any of the marketing materials for the film, it has that very simple, almost like Arial type font where it just says The Thing in plain white. And then in the film, of course, we get the throwback to the original with the burning through. And, you know, it's like if we didn't know that Carpenter was a fan of The Thing from the fact that it's all over Halloween, that alone kind of shoots you off that, okay, obviously he's a fan of the original, he's going to give us something good.
Well, that was another thing that Spielberg invented was the, like, and somebody was bound to invent it just because it was a time period of the television generation, but where, you know, where movies immediately started, you know, from probably like, it's probably started in Close Encounters, you know, there was lots of TV shots in Close Encounters with ironic or funny or tributes to something that he liked in the background. And, that became a standard thing in movies up to this day, you know. There's, you know, I don't remember which movies they had in them, but I remember the Scream movies had, you know, something that they were paying tribute to.
Well, in the original Scream, they're watching Halloween at the party.
Oh, that's right.
And they talk about... Because the one guy says, "Oh, I want to see your tits," and he says, "No, no, Jamie Lee Curtis didn't show her tits until she went legit," which is true.
Yeah, it is true. The exact opposite.
I mean, I'm younger than you guys. Okay, so I was born in 1980. So I've always, you know, television has always been just a commonplace, accepted thing, you know, for as long as I've been alive. Just like for as long as I can remember, computers have been something that wasn't, you know. If we didn't, you know, the personal computer, the small computer, was a normal thing for me.
Damn, man, you know your shit so much, I'm just assuming you're my age.
I thought you were older than I was.
I'm feeling bad, yeah. I'm feeling bad.
You know, this is what I do. I research shit, so. I'm an engineer by trade, so I'm detail-oriented, I guess.
Uh-huh.
But you're right. It's, you know, if you want to, now it's, we talked about this with the last film, too, on In Prince of Darkness. You know, there's a couple of scenes where television plays not an important role, but it's a kind of a background role that's conveying information to the audience. You know, because we talk about it, we see the thing about the supernova, and we see the Tom and Jerry cartoon. You know, here, the only TV we get is for a gag, but it's still used for informational purposes to the audience.
Yeah. That's true. I'm still getting over the 1980 thing, man.
I think I just
sprouted some crow's nest on my eyes. Crow's feet. Crow's nest. Yeah, that's quite a picture, the crow's nest sprouting from my face.
You sprouted the lookout from a pirate ship?
Exactly. it's an odd genetic thing that runs in my family.
Yeah. I remember the first time I saw the thing, Christ, I had to be about 6 or 7, and my father was, he was hell-bent on getting my brother and I exposed to as much monsters as we could. I remember when I right around my 7th birthday, we saw Predator and RoboCop on a double feature in the theater.
What a happy day, man.
Oh my God, that was awesome. But anyway.
I remember my day seeing RoboCop in the theater, and that was wonderful. Seeing both of those together must have been just, like, over the top.
Oh, yeah. But, so, it was one night, you know, I don't know where, my mom must have been working, because my mom was a visiting nurse, so she'd have to work weekends sometimes. And, you know, my dad's like, oh, we're going to watch this. And so him, my brother, myself, my dad sat down, we watched John Carpenter's The Thing. And it, you know, the thing is, I don't even remember being scared by it. I remember the effects, and I remember, like, the dogs and stuff, but I think I was actually too young to be scared by this movie when I watched it.
Wow.
I mean, it freaked me out, don't get me wrong, but, you know, that's the problem when you watch a film that young.
Oh, I don't know. My father showed me Alien when I was about 7. Scared the bejesus out of me.
Oh, my God. Well, that's how I saw Alien, is my dad took my dad would take me and my friends out to the movies, or me out to the movies, and be like, all right, here's the story. We're going to see the Bad News Bears. You guys have all seen the Bad News Bears, right? Okay. Got your story straight? Yeah, okay. It was a great movie, right? It was really funny. You liked it? Okay, we're going to see Alien. And then he would go, and he would love seeing all my friends get the shit scared out of them. Or we'd take us to see Stripes, and we'd get to see boobies and stuff. But I remember going to see Alien, and, you know, with all my goofy friends, and we're all goofing around, and about, you know, a half hour into the movie, you know, it's just slack jaws and, you know, quivering bottom lips. It must have been awesome for him.
Yeah.
I remember, yeah, that was I just remember seeing this movie and going, damn, man, you know, they're really going for the realism. It wasn't, you know, I remember, like, Siskel and Ebert made a big deal about this is a good movie, but it's a hard R. It's very bloody and disturbing, and it was very gory, but for the most part, the gore was not, it wasn't as much, it was disturbing because it was this creature turning into things, but it wasn't like as much, yeah, people do get their hands chopped off, and people are getting stuff done to them, but most of the really, like, horrifying effects are this creature changing or just doing its thing, which is gory, but just bizarre. It's like something out of a Lovecraft story or something.
It's fantastical.
Yes, but, you know, at the same time,
it's never
played
any suggestion of something that you can relate to on a one-to-one level for the most part.
But it still works. It still happens in its own logic. The creature has its own logic, and it makes sense. And you play into the reality of it. You know, by watching what it's doing, you're realizing, oh my God, it's taking over. You know, you can see it, you know, absorbing the genetics of whatever it is it kills and takes over. And I found the whole thing fascinating, and I was just like, always, I was a huge fan of John Carpenter, so I was sort of expecting it of him after Halloween, and at that point I think I'd only seen Halloween and Escape from New York, and this was like sort of upping the ante. I thought the cinematography was better than any movie he'd had before, you know, the music was perfect. And I think we were talking before, but you Luke pointed out to me that John Carpenter didn't write the music.
No,
to this one.
It was Ennio Morricone who did the music for The Thing.
Who's such an amazing composer, and he sounds like John Carpenter in this.
It's a very kind of straightforward synth score, which you would expect John Carpenter would just do it.
Yeah, save the money.
There is speculation that Carpenter did rewrite and re-record a lot of the score for this, though. That's why you kind of get that pulsating heartbeat sound. I think that's more Carpenter than Morricone.
Oh, I never...
That's interesting. I hadn't heard that, but I believe it.
Oh, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Because I...
Especially considering how much Carpenter will... You know, it's common for him to do his own music. You know, that's one of his traits.
Mm-hmm.
And so what my thought was is that this was, we talk about this being a step up in terms of cinematography and look and everything else. One of the things that's clear watching The Thing compared to especially his earlier films is that you know where the money went in this movie. This movie looks like, we talked about how The Thing from Another World was an A picture. This is the same with Carpenter's The Thing. This is an A picture. You know, from everything from the location shots to the effects to the use of the helicopters to, you know, that the whole thing, it looks like a class act.
Yeah, which doesn't happen much in the genre, you know.
Right, and Carpenter's films especially, you know, up to this point, you know, when a Carpenter's things is like Roger Corman, it's make, you use what you got and make it work. If you know, his films weren't ever large budget. You know, Halloween certainly wasn't a large budget film. You know, Escape from New York, certainly not a large budget film. And, you know, looking at them, they look gritty and harsh, you know, and from a cinematic point of view, whereas The Thing looks like a money movie, which helps it because it has to sell more and there's more suspension of disbelief than there is in something like Halloween.
Yes. And I mean, I remember there was a magazine. I don't know if it still exists. It was called Cinema Fantastique.
Good old Cinema Fantastique.
And where I lived, you know, every once in a while, sometimes I would find it on a magazine rack, and it was one of those magazines I'd more hear about, like in the pages of Fangoria or I can't remember the other one, Starlog. You know, I would hear about this magazine, but I finally found one in Watertown, New York, and it was The Thing issue, and it was all about, you know, the making of the special effects and the set design, and they put a lot of time and effort. I mean, the whole set of their base just had such an insanely lived-in feeling, you know, when you would be in people's rooms, you could see, you know, each room had that person's personality in it and looked like that person had lived in it for a long time, you know, for months and months and months. And all the actors seemed like they'd been around each other for a long time. And I think this movie, to me, I put this on the same level as, like, Alien and The Exorcist as A-level horror movies. And I think maybe it didn't get the kudos that those movies did, because maybe it didn't have... It was more of a... movie full of character actors rather than any E.T.
I'm telling you, man, it's E.T. E.T. killed this movie. Why would you go see the people getting ripped apart when you could watch The Happy Alien?
And you know what's funny about that is that E.T., when it was being produced, was predicted to be a bomb to rival those dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Yes.
And that's why M&M's wouldn't work with it. You know, people were advising Spielberg to get out now before he released it. I mean, the whole film was supposed to be a disaster, and it comes out and it kicks everything's ass, including Carpenter.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm always the kind of guy, I like the good alien, but I like the bad. I like the really bad alien too, you know? I mean, I was all over E.T. when that came out too, but you know, I was also into the I think it during that time too, there was also, you know, the hardcore GRU people were down for that stuff, but there was this sort of, it was almost like the rise of the, it was early in the rise of the Christian right sort of vibe, where bloody movies were looked at as almost like dirty and, you know, and bad. They had a sleazy, you know, a sleazy stain to them. And yes, this is a very violent movie, but it's no more violent than any World War II movie. You know, and it's equally as well written as any other kind of movie you could think of. And I think if it would have had, like, Paul Newman in it or something, you know, it would have added to that. I guess.
I think what you're shooting for, it would have given it more mainstream credibility.
Yeah, and you know, they would have had an actor that they could have said, well, you know, so-and-so does a really good job. Although every actor in this movie does a really good job. Character actors, I think, are the best actors in the world. I personally think, like, Nicholson and De Niro, they're character actors. All these people that are, like, the most vaunted actors for the most part, or the... You know, maybe not like Leonardo DiCaprio types, or like that. But you know, the hardcore Pacinos and stuff. They're all character actors. And you know, I mean, I can't remember the one guy's name, but the one guy who, you know, gets pissed off about being tied down to the couch. He's a classic, you know, character actor. And Wilford Brimley, come on.
I love Wilford Brimley in this movie. One of my favorite lines from any film of all time. See this? This isn't dog. It's imitation.
Yeah.
Anybody? I mean, it's a pretty. When you think about that line in detail, it does. You know, it's pretty. It's pretty silly. But Wilford Brimley sells it. And you're like, yeah. Okay, because you know, because he's seen. Blair has seen everything. You know, nothing fazes him. The fact that there's an alien shape-shifting into a dog, it's like Tuesday to him. And that, and Wilford Brimley sells that so well that you automatically gives it gravitas, and it's boom, it's right there.
Yep, and this was before Wilford Brimley got really kind of bloated and grumpy and like sort of the parody of himself. This was when, you know, he was a, you know, I mean, he kind of reminded me of John Goodman. You know, that sort, you know. The big gravelly sort of guy instead of the grumpy grandfatherly type of guy. You know, everybody in this most of the people in this movie were one form of tough guy or another. And this was also, thankfully, before the whole tough guy thing got really, you know, exaggerated. So, you know, the only real, you know, what was Kurt Russell's foils, those are the two alpha
Childs.
He's the only other like sort of steroided up, but if this movie were made today, those guys would be huge. They would be like more buffed up and more militant. But you know, I mean, Carpenter sort of put the two alpha males in, but everybody else is still sort of gritty in some way. Some are the old school sort of military, you know, grit type. Some are just sort of the,
just the grizzled type.
Yeah, they're
seen that, been there, done that.
Yeah, and Carpenter is a master of that. Carpenter is a master of the, you know, the character full of tough, or the movie full of tough guys. And this movie has no women in it, unless any of those dogs might happen to be female. There's no feminine energy to this movie at all.
You know, the chess computer.
Yeah, but she gets wiped out in the first scene.
I know, it's
and,
great.
And do we know who plays the chess computer?
Was it Barbeau?
Adrian Barbeau, exactly.
Of course it was.
Even as a computer, she's hot.
Oh, yeah.
You don't know, like, you know how small towns will take anything as a point of pride? And I hope someday John Carpenter listens to this, because I'm sure he'd get a kick out of it. But John Carpenter, if you're listening out there, the whole town of Carthage, New York was so proud of, like, no matter how bloody your movies were, they were just really proud that, you know, that there was somebody from Carthage who was making famous movies. But when you married Adrian Barbeau, oh my God, people went berserk. Oh, they were so proud of you. Oh my God, can you believe a boy from Carthage married her? Did you see her in Swamp Thing? Oh my God, she had her boobs out. They're huge. That's a Carthage boy.
He's not the best looking dude in the world either.
No. No, and if you went to Carthage, New York, you'd see that. You'd see how shallow that gene pool is, you know? Seriously, there's like, well, there's like four or five big family names around there, and you can sort of take everybody else and like, okay, that guy's a little bit of Cross and a little bit of, you know, Gil. And you
know.
So we were very proud of him for Adrian Barbeau, and we're very upset when it didn't work out between the two of them.
You know, one thing that's one of the direct parallels I think you can draw between The Thing from Another World and The Thing, we talked about this, is the sense of paranoia. But, you know, in keeping with the context, whereas The Thing from Another World was that early Cold War, you know, us versus them sort of paranoia, Thing, of course, is indicative of the you can't trust who's around you. Nobody trusts anybody now, is what MacReady says.
Yeah.
And it's funny, again, because we talked about this the last time on Prince of Darkness. But again, that to me, hearing it now especially, sounds directly like a sort of commentary on, you know, that this was right in the second year of Reagan's first term, you know, as conflict, potential conflict and rhetoric between the United States and the Soviet Union was stepping up once again. You know, there was the threat of nuclear annihilation, and nobody trusts anybody anymore. You know, which is a theme you see a lot in Carpenter's films. One thing I thought about with that was, I don't remember if this is actually in the dialogue of Halloween or if it's just in the novelization, where they talk about that, you know, Haddonfield was a town where nobody ever locked their doors. And after, you know, Michael kills his sister, now nobody trusted anybody anymore, and they had to lock their doors now. And it's that kind of loss of trust and the dehumanization of modernist society. You know, that's a theme that shows up again and again in Carpenter's film. It's kind of at its zenith here.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and it's funny. You know, I was just thinking, if The Thing from Another World had been made like 5 years later, it might have had a little more of that paranoia turned inward. You know, it might have hit more of the McCarthy era, where we were starting to suspect ourselves of being communists also, you know, that whole sort of time period. But it was before that, when it was more pure. The us versus them was more pure. And another thing, you know, a little subtext of this was, I guess it's sort of, both movies are sort of set near Russia. It was interesting that they sort of transferred the old movie, you know, the discovery of the spaceship and stuff over to the Swedish, to the Swedish people. So it all starts. The whole movie starts with, you know, two outsiders coming into the camp, the dog and, you know, the Swedish crew with the helicopter.
Yeah.
And you know, the truly evil outsider is taken in, while the other outsiders are basically, they're basically wiped out just for a failure to communicate. is
well,
what it is.
Well, they take themselves out, though.
Well, they shoot the one guy in the head because he's taking pot shots at the dog and running at him. But if they could have spoken, you know, if somebody would have been there to translate, or the Swedish guy would have slowed down and maybe drawn a picture and said, kill that dog, yeah. You know, or done something to explain himself rather than just run with a gun without explanation, shooting at a dog and acting crazy, you know. Yeah. But they, you know, they think he's just gone nuts. And another thing that I love about this movie is that dog is a great actor. Man,
oh, yeah.
The scenes where that dog's just... I mean, there's a few. They made a dummy dog for the parts where he's standing stock, you know, unnaturally still. But the scenes where the dog's just sort of walking and stopping and looking and coldly assessing the situation, it's truly, really creepy because it's a real dog. And it's not acting like most dogs act in a movie, like looking off screen at its trainer or whatever. It truly looks like a weird robot possessed dog.
Yeah. And what's interesting is on the documentary that's on the DVD, they talk about that dog, and apparently that dog is in fact half wolf. And so his manner, the way he moved and the way that he looked was all very wolf-like, and they discuss how he never barked, you know, he wouldn't wag his tail a lot, and the guy who played Clark, which is Richard Masur, who was the dog handler, he said on the documentary, he says that what the handler said was, if he gives you that look, that wolf stare, when he's sizing you up, just stay calm. He says, don't try and do anything, don't approach him, just give him a minute to calm down. Because and you're right, because, you know, we look at them, and I grew up with Siberian Husky dogs as pets.
Uh-huh.
So you look at them, it's like, oh, it's a Husky dog. But then you see the way his manner is, like, there's something wrong with the dog. You know, not that, oh, he's hurt or he's sick. No, there's something wrong with that dog.
Yeah, there's something completely different than your doggy dog is going on there. Yeah. I mean, truly, it's the best dog acting I've seen since... A Boy and then Blood in A Boy and His Dog.
Another great dog performance.
My favorite dog performance of all time. But this dog is pretty damn good. There's a whole bunch of good dogs. The scene with in the kennel where the one dog's, you know, tearing out the cage with his teeth in his...
biting out the chicken wire, yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. I don't know how they... I don't know if that's like chicken wire that's made out of like sugar or something, and you know, but
it's made of meat.
It's like made out of beef jerky that they've like spray painted with like food coloring to look silver or something. But boy, that's a really intense scene, and it looks completely realistic. Now I don't. It looked for all the world like they had a real dog.
Yeah.
Trained to
well,
do that.
Well, you know, I said that I was really young when I saw this, and I was probably too young to be scared by it. You know, at the time, you know, all little boys at some point are into monsters and blood and guts and all that stuff. And you know, considering what I remember the film from the first time I watched it, I think that was more the level I was engaged on, was the monster level, you know? And so I always remember the scene with the kennel. I always remembered that one of the scenes that you talk about is the dog biting his way out of the kennel, you know, because that's just not something you expect. And then, you know, I mean, the kennel scene in and of itself kind of introduces us to what we're going to be in for the next you know, 90 minutes or so. And I don't know. There's some argument on this, but I would say The Thing is definitely in the top three grossest films of all time.
Yes.
Yeah, it's pretty damn gross.
I mean, you can say something is gorier, something is nastier, but as far as just gross out, this movie is up there.
It's in David Cronenberg land, really, weirdness.
Well, you're getting the color of, it's not even just blood, but it's like yellow pus and green shit and everything just going everywhere, and it, ugh.
And it's not just all that viscera and stuff. The way they made this creature move, when a head would pop out of a gut and snarl at you, it didn't just open up its mouth. It was like quivering. It was so much energy is just like throbbing through it, and it's enraged and, you know, angry and in pain or whatever, scared and or just pissed. But
yeah, well, go ahead.
Yeah, it just had this energy about it that was completely alien, and I mean, isn't that like the first line is like, you know, there's something in here and it's pissed or,
yeah,
whatever the line was, there's something's in there and it's pissed.
Yeah. And, well, one of the statements that Rob Bottin, who did the visual effects, he says on the documentary, he says that the phrase that they used over and over was wild imagination. It's like, what can we do, and how can we make it work, and what can we do, and what's something they've never seen before? You know, he said every time they would come to a new gag they had to do, what's the wildest thing we can imagine? What I always loved about the effects in this film is that nothing is static. You know, everything is dynamic.
Yeah.
You know, when the dog, it's like, it's one thing, and then something else happens, and then something else happens, and then something else happens, and it's all in the same shot. And it's like normally you get your one shot, and that's your payoff, that's your money shot. It's like, no, we're going to push the envelope again and again here.
Oh, yeah. This time the head comes off and sprouts legs, you know? I mean, and that point, that was one of those awesome... You know, I usually hate the parts where a character speaks for the audience, but and I think you know what the scene, yeah, where he looks at the head with the legs on it, and just goes, "You got to be fucking kidding me!" You know, and you know, at that point, I remember watching that, thinking the exact same thing, going, "Come on, this is insane!" You know, and I think that was right after, you know, the thing, the chest cavity sprouted teeth and, you know, bit the guy's arms off, or, you know, hands off.
That effect and that's so good.
That is.
Yes.
And the way that they did that effect is so just funny. It's just so funny in that it's like Poverty Row filmmaking ideas, but it works. What they did was they got a guy who had lost both of his hands on his forearms in an industrial accident. And they fitted him with latex hands filled with gelatin, and they had, I think, celery for the bone and stuff. And they actually put, you know, his arms with these fake appliance hands inside a hydraulic press, rigged to look like the teeth on the monster, and then hit it, and then he pulled them up. And that's why the skin tears, and there's all the you can see the tissue in every side, because it's the end of the latex. It's like, of course, get a guy with no arms to be the guy who loses his hands.
And, man, just let's take our hats off just for a second for physical gags. Because if this movie was done today, there would be so much CGI, and it wouldn't look as good. If that's just such a weird thought to think, if this movie was made today, it wouldn't look as good as it did when it was made then, because another thing that would have been different is the shot when they do find that, when they finally go to where, you know, the Swedish people had found the UFO, that would have all been computer generated instead of a nice old fashioned, you know, matte painting.
Yeah.
big old beautiful matte painting, and it just, yeah, it wouldn't have. I can see how this movie would look CGI, and you know, this time the head would hop down off the table and like leap up onto the wall and grab onto it and stuff. But I like the way they did it, where they would like, you know, hook tentacles onto something and then pull them away and then show it in reverse to show the tentacles whip out and grab something. And you know, there's maybe it's because
there's something too when you have an effect, and this has been true going back to the days of like Harryhausen, going to the Soup Nation days in Toho, all that stuff. One thing that's a theory that my brother and I have always talked about, and I'll talk to anybody who'll ever listen, is that going back to the days of like Ray Harryhausen and Toho, Soup Nation, and anything like that, if you've got a physical effect, something that has mass and volume, and if you were there in the studio, you could reach out and touch it, something that the effect is in the frame, okay, not something added in post-prod, it'll always look better than something relatively the same quality that's CG or otherwise added in post-prod, because you know the eye is used to looking at objects that are three-dimensional. And so if we see a three-dimensional object, even if it's a model, we're more likely, I think, from the, you know, seeing it visually to understanding it in our brain, I think we're able to understand it better and take it for what it is and see it as a three-dimensional thing, as opposed to something like, oh, that's clearly CG.
Right, you know? Right.
Even the not-so-jaded amongst us can look at CG and recognize it as CG right away.
Well, sometimes you can just tell CG because you know it physically couldn't be done that smoothly in real life, you know, when something hops up. But there's also just super subtle cues that the eye and the subconscious pick up that are almost impossible to, you know, they're constantly fine-tuning them and, now we have, you know, they have the flesh moving more like flesh and stuff, but it's still, there's so many, you know, variables, and even to the point of if you have something CG'd, it's not the same light falling on it that's falling on everything else, whereas if you have a physical effect, it's the same light on everything, so everything gets that same quality, and you can simulate that in a computer. It's never quite perfect, you know, maybe someday it will be. I personally doubt it. I think they've got CG to the point now where we'll see how when I can take a better look at Jeff Bridges in the new Tron movie. But, you know, I mean, they're getting close to the point of where you could, I'm waiting for the time where they have a CG human in a movie and they don't tell anybody about it for a while. You know, they let the movie be out for a little while and say, oh, by the way, you know, blah blah blah, CG in that movie. That's what I'm waiting for. That might be a few more years down the line, but you know, it's gonna happen someday. It will.
Oh yeah, it definitely will.
I swear. But yeah, if you know, I'm amazed nobody's remade this movie yet. You know, maybe because the Fog remake didn't do too good. They're remaking New York.
Yeah, but they actually have they have produced a prequel to this film that is going to be released next year.
Really?
It's going to tell the story of the I don't remember if they're Swedish or Norwegian, but it's going to tell the story of the first team.
I've been calling them Swedish. Sorry, Norwegians. I know the Norwegians are good. There's a difference.
Macready does the same thing though, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think he does. Oh, okay, so I'm like Kurt Russell. Okay, that's good.
Oh, it's going to have a chick in it.
Yes, great. It will.
But we know how that story turns out.
Yeah, they all
die. We know how the Star Wars prequels turn out, too, but that didn't stop
true.
Lucas, did it?
That's true. That is absolutely true. But, it seemed like Carpenter was just going to be running through his whole, you know, set of movies with remakes with I never saw the Assault on Precinct 13 remake.
I couldn't even get through it.
Really? It was. I thought there was hope because I think John Leguizamo is one of my favorite character actors, genre actors, and usually when he shows up in something, even in movies that I don't like, I usually enjoy his performance. So I saw he was in it, so I thought there might be some.
Taken on its own, it was okay. Certainly not good, but as a remake of Assault on Precinct 13, it wasn't very good at all.
Okay, yes, yeah. What's the point? You know, if you're, you know, I mean, Assault on Precinct 13 is a really good movie, but it's one of his early ones, and it's a little rough. It could get, you know, you could take that movie, remake it, and tweak it up a little bit and make it actually better, you know. But yeah. Well, I guess. That would also... Carpenter was... I think he was involved in both of those, at least as a producer, but I don't know if he was really, like...
Do you know what his involvement is? Give me the check for using
my
movie.
Yeah, stamp it and cash a check, you know? That's what that's what I sort of hope it is, because I would hope that he wasn't going, yeah, you know, actually, I think this is a really good script. Yeah, go ahead. I haven't seen The Fog either.
Let's say when the remake was made of Last House on the Left, I read an interview with Wes Craven where he said that, you know, at this point in his career and in his life, he kind of takes, you know, the films have stopped being his children to a degree. Now they're kind of like his grandchildren.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, he's happy that they're still getting attention and that people like them so much that they want to make a new version of it, and he wants to see what somebody can do with his film and how they can make it different than his or better than his.
Well, that's,
you know, and I would think that Carpenter might have a similar approach to it to Craven, considering the you know, regard by which their films are held by genre fans.
Right. Well, I always think that it's usually the fans that are more, that get more into preserving, you know, that stuff than the actual the actual creators of stuff, you know. I think the actual creators of their work are sometimes amused to see, yeah, like just like you said, they're amused to see what people do with them, and they're not as, you know, they don't hold them as sacrosanct as the fans do, and maybe don't get as wound up about somebody taking liberties with them or abusing them, because they, you know, it's their children. They've let their children go into the world and are not. But it's kind of weird.
Yeah.
But
I mean, we're in a day and age where they just remade I Spit on Your Grave. So
did they remake I Spit on Your Grave?
I think it's in limited release right now.
Really?
Yeah, my brother was telling me. I didn't realize. You know, I mean. I Spit on Your Grave is one of those films where it's like, it's one of those ones where you really need a shower after watching it.
Yeah. It's definitely was way before politically correct was even a sparkle in any politically correct person's eye. Yeah, that movie was wrong in so many ways, and I remember watching that, you know, that was a movie that was made, that it was out in the movie theaters, but it got made famous because Siskel and Ebert just denounced the hell out of it, and then it immediately was out on video, you know, and we were right down to the video store watching it, just going, how many times is this girl going to get raped before she moves off this island? You know, it's like, you know, at the very first, you know... It was just, you know, there was no logic to it, and yeah, and there's some penis chopping in that was really horribly a traumatic thing for a, you know, 14-year-old group of boys to watch. But yeah, I remember watching that movie going, this is no normal, you know, bloody movie. The people who made this, literally, they really have some problems, you know, or it was worse than, well, I remember seeing Last House on the Left. The original Last House on the Left gave me a sort of creepy, super creepy, dirty feeling afterwards, but there was a lot more brain power put behind it, you know, There was, which I don't know if that makes it any better or whatever, but this movie was just pure, like, ugliness. And it usually took quite a bit to get Ebert tisking. He was buddies with Russ Meyer.
Well, I mean, you talk about Ebert on The Thing. His quote was, he called it a barf bag movie.
Yeah.
And I've got the quote here. He says that he calls the special effects among the most elaborate, nauseating, and horrifying sights yet achieved by Hollywood's new generation of visual magicians. And
he was saying that as if it was a bad thing.
Yeah. It's like that's kind of the point, isn't it, Dodge?
Well, that's what got me into the movie, because this was one of the few movies that he would get in a righteous huff and puff about, you know? I mean, and I remember when Halloween came out, he that was another one. I want to warn you, you know, this isn't, don't take your children to this one, and don't go to it unless you like horror movies, but, you know. But this one was one where he came out and, like, was self-righteous and denounced it, you know, just... Poof. Which I remember that made me want to see it, but then when I saw it, I said, yeah. What movie did he see? You know, this is an engaging movie, you know.
And another critic who hates this film is Leonard Maltin.
Well, Leonard Maltin. who gave
Laser Blast 2.5 stars. You know, Laser Blast by I can't think of his name now, from Full Moon Entertainment. I got nothing.
That's the movie with the stop motion alien and the gun.
Stop motion aliens, yeah. Charles Band's Laser Blast. It was the last film from the original run of Mystery Science Theater 3000 before they got picked up by Sci-Fi Channel. They gave Laser Blast 2.5 stars, and John Carpenter's The Thing 1.5 stars.
Jeez.
Like, seriously? Did we watch the same movies?
I'm not a fan of Leonard Maltin myself. I don't like Leonard Maltin. I think he's a...
You know what I like, Leonard Maltin? I like his big DVD or his big film review book, the one that's about 4 inches thick, because that one's really good for getting, like, years things was made and running time and things of that nature.
Ebert has a bunch of those books, too, that are really good. You know, they're comprehensive video guides. Those books are just made to sit right by your shitter. Those are like ultimate, you know, put them right by the toilet and you're good to go for months with those books. Yeah, I could take Leonard Maltin at that. I just can't take him if I could see him speaking and hear him speaking. Yeah, I don't like him. I don't know. Most movie critics are very annoying to me. I never was a fan of Jeffrey Lyons either.
Yeah.
I don't know. I always liked Siskel and Ebert, and most everybody else was. And I could read Pauline Kael. But I don't know why. Oh, that's right. We were talking about the denouncers.
Yeah.
This is probably John Carpenter's most widely denounced movie. Outside of Halloween,
which is amazing considering the regard in which it is held today.
Yeah,
the secondary audience that it received on video and cable, now everybody kind of discovered this film, and you know now we kind of take that for granted that if a film doesn't do, you know, if a genre film doesn't do good at the box office, we're like, it'll find its audience on DVD. But back then, you know, I mean, the home video market was still kind of burgeoning. And the idea of a premium cable market, you know, I mean, you couldn't get HBO in every state. You couldn't get HBO in every city, you know?
Yeah.
So the idea of a film finding its audience on HBO, people are like, you know, that'll never happen.
And you know,
but
now
the thing definitely found it.
And you know, now that I'm thinking of it, this one might have been really a groundbreaking movie in the whole modern idea of not as much the remake, but the remake as a reimagining. You know, because I think, you know, that got, picked up on and moved forward with The Fly when Cronenberg did The Fly.
Yeah.
You know, I think both of these movies, when they came out, you know, you would actually have the critic would be explaining sort of what, Now, this isn't really a remake of the movie. It's sort of just the basic idea of it. So it's completely, you know, they would... And nowadays, you don't even think about that. That's just any remake comes out as some sort of reboot, reimagining. You know, there's even multiple words for it now.
Yeah. Well, now if something sticks close to the original, you're surprised.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, that's about all I got on this one. I think from my, my voluminous notes, half a sheet of paper.
Yeah. You can't take too many notes, otherwise then you're just discussing minutiae.
Uh-huh. You know?
I'll just start some closing thoughts. One thing that I noticed about this film, and I said it before, this film is harsh. It's harsh in its dialogue. It's harsh in the look of the visual effects. It's harsh in its attitude. It's harsh in its energy. This is a film that, if I had to pick one word to describe it, it would be harsh. You know, this is a harsh environment with a harsh climate. These guys do a harsh work here. You know, once the alien is released, everybody's at each other's throats. You know, MacReady and Childs look ready to kill each other every time they see each other. There's a lot of that kind of harshness about it. And that's, you know, that's something that you can't, you know, you can't manufacture that. That comes about because of a genuine chemistry between the director and the cast, between the individual members of the cast, and that is something that you just can't make that up. And when you catch it in a bottle, it works, and when it works, it works.
Yep, I would add the word visceral to that, just because it's visceral in spirit, and there's lots of actual physical viscera thrown around and chucked here and there. But yeah, I think this is a movie that was totally underestimated and now has become an acknowledged classic. You know, it's transcended all that abuse, and I don't know, you know, its original, you know, I don't think it really, I don't know if it was a flop, but I don't think it really made an awful lot of money when it came out, but it's now a genuine horror classic.
Yeah, it's pretty damn good. That's all I can say about it. I mean,
I love the you know, Hero, they say the brevity is the soul of wit, and you, sir, definitely are that. I don't know what that says about me, who can't shut up. But.
Oh, me neither. We need somebody who's going to just boil it down, you know?
I could boil it down like this. If we're done recording, would you kindly untie me from this fucking chair?
Did you know? You can sponsor an episode of this or any other of your favorite Two True Freaks affiliated shows. That's right. Simply click the PayPal link on our website, donate any amount at all, tell us which show you're choosing and what message, if any, you'd like us to read on your behalf, and you will be an official sponsor of that show's very next episode, with your message read in the show's opener. It's that easy, and there is no minimum donation. Be a show sponsor today. Visit our website at twotruefreaks.libsyn.com. Twotruefreaks.libsyn.com is spelled twotruefreaks.libsyn, which is libsyn.com.
You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com.
You can find me, Scott Gardner, both on Twitter and Facebook. My name is spelled ScottGardner. Two True Freaks is a very proud member of the League of Comic Book Podcasts. For more information, visit comicbooknoise.com/league.
We are also members of the Comics Podcast Network. You can check it out at www.comicspodcasts.com, where you can hear our new episodes when we put them up. Thanks for listening.
Join us every Monday for new episodes of Two True Freaks.
Two True Freaks has been brought to you today by Damanzo Core of Milan, Italy, and by the letters F and U.
You gotta be fucking kidding.